views and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 97.5 on the FM channel, 660 on the AM channel. Yes, we still do that. We live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruz. If you have a question for today's guest, we're at 907-458-TALK. That's 907-458-8255. However, since we do have North Korean equipment that's being put here by Perry Wally, general manager and my boss, I doubt if you'll be able to miss that. Our guests will be able to hear your question, so I'll try and relay it for them if you call in. But we're bringing in people from Anchorage to fix our North Korean equipment. With that in mind, got Nick Nugent in here on a Wednesday. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great, Dave.
And you brought in someone, Keys. How you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. You know, I'm totally honored to be on a show called Problem Corner.
Now, basically, I'm going to introduce you a little bit. Then I'm going to let Nick handle the interview. You went by the stage name Mr. White Keys in Anchorage at the Fly By Night Club in Spinard.
Yes.
And that's where I'm going to leave it. And Mr. Nugent, it's your show, sir.
Thank you, Dave. I'm really looking forward to what we're having today. This is going to be another story of a great historical event in Alaska, which was mostly brought up by serendipity.
He's an event? Keys, are you an event? I thought you were a historical person.
Well, the event would be the book and the voyage of the Alaska Union up to the Koyukuk country for mining. And morning, Keys. How's everything?
It's fabulous. You know, and I was going to say that, about Problem Corner, you know, I've never wanted to be part of the problem. I've always wanted to be the whole problem.
Well, we're the solutions, though. We solve problems, so I'm in a conundrum.
I believe that the name of the program, Problem Corner, goes back just about as far as you do in Alaska on-the-air personalities. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in a historical subject?
Well, you know, I'm just a sleazy guy, and, made my living by mouthing off and making snotty comments over the years. And, you know, we did an Alaska comedy, musical comedy review for years at the Fly By Nightclub. And I've always liked history, but, you know, I'm not a historian. And then just, a few years ago, totally by accident. See, I mean, nothing in my life has ever been planned. I mean, it's all accidental. It's dumb luck. It's just the luck of the draw. And what happened here a few years back was that my girlfriend and I were in Hawaii in the winter for a couple weeks, and we were snorkeling on a reef because they were sort of amateur marine biologists, and we're out there on the reef, and we hear somebody yelling from shore, "Hey, Keys!" And I look up out of the water, and I see a couple people in the distance on shore that I knew from Anchorage, and they're sort of friends of ours. We didn't know them very well at the time. And so we got out of the water later that day, and we called them up, and they introduced us to their friends that they were over there staying with, who are also from Anchorage. And we got together, and we all were, fanatics about marine life and coral reefs. Stuff. So we all started hanging out snorkeling together, and after about 5 years of this, Randy, who's there, our friend's friend, invites us over for dinner, and we're over there having ribs, and he makes the best ribs in me?
No, he doesn't. I do. I take that as a challenge, but go ahead.
I would love to see that challenge because Randy's ribs are like nothing I've ever had. So we're sitting there at dinner, and somebody mentioned something about the history of Alaska, something I read. And Randy says, you know, we've known him now for 5 years, and Randy says, well, that's like when my grandfather was up there in the gold rush in 1898. And we said, wait a minute, Randy, you never told us that. And he said, oh, yeah. He says, not only was he up there, but he carried a big old 40-pound camera and took pictures of the whole time that he was up there. And we said, well, Randy, have you ever seen these pictures? Oh, yeah, I got them in a big box in my basement. And I just, you know, I mean, I sprained every muscle in my neck, you know, just turning around and saying, holy smokes, I mean, you know, nobody's ever seen this stuff. No, it's all been in the basement, you know, for 120 years. So I insisted on seeing this. And then he's got a manuscript, you know, about these slides. He used to do slideshows after he came back, you know, in 1900, 1901. Every time for the next 40 years that anybody he asked him at the drop of a hat, he had these photographs converted to a glass lantern slideshow, and he would go give talks on his trip to Alaska. And one time, in like in the late 1930s, he was giving a talk at the Masonic Temple in Chicago, where he was from, and somebody there transcribed the talk word for word. So we've got this, the slides, the photos that were in the slideshow, we've got the transcript of the talk. And again, this is all in Randy's basement, and nobody's seen it for, you know, 120 years. And I immediately said, well, this has got to be preserved. This is a major part of Alaska history, and it's got to be preserved. Nobody's ever written about this expedition before. I mean, there have been a few things written about the Koyukuk Gold Rush, but nothing about this expedition. And, you know, I couldn't find anybody that would do it, you know, any friends of mine that were historians or archaeologists. So there was a pandemic coming on, and I said, well, I got nothing else to do. I'll do it. So I started researching this, and, you know, 3 years later, we've got a book. It's the story of this expedition to the Gold Rush.
What's the name of the book again?
The Voyage of the Alaska Union.
Okay.
Adventure, Danger, Scurvy, Romance.
Sounds like the Fly-By Nightclub.
Well, yeah, the romance part is sort of a lie.
Yeah, but scurvy, you know, what the heck.
There were only seven women in the territory. The Gold Rush was not really big on romance.
No, not at all.
Well, Keith, then you apparently had the materials you've just described, did you find much else written about the area at that time?
Oh, well, yeah, that was it. I mean, I started with the couple of books that had been written about this, and one by Chris Allen from up there in Fairbanks, the National Park Service book about the Alaskan Odyssey, is just a great source. And there were a couple other things that were written back in the 80s, but, you know, nothing that covered this particular expedition. But then, I started researching old newspaper archives, and the Gold Rush was a big deal in 1898. I mean, it was right when the Klondike had hit. And it's like they said 100,000 people took off for the Klondike and the Gold Rush, in Dawson City. Now, not all of them made it. Maybe 30,000 of them made it, but it was big news, and every newspaper in the country carried articles about the Gold Rush, you know, constantly. And anytime anybody went up north for the Gold Rush, they would write letters home or write letters to their newspapers, and those would all be printed. So going back in the archives for, 100 years, there are all kinds of articles and letters from people that have been written. Plus, there are diaries in museums and archives, and there are a few books that were written by guys at the time that have pretty much disappeared. but they can be found. And, you know, I kept, you know, seeing one thing after another. And then I saw a one-sentence quote in, I believe it was Chris Allen's book, about somebody that was on this expedition. So I called Chris Allen and I said, you know, where did this, where were the rest of this, these papers? And he said, oh, there's this guy, George Lounsbury has him in Fairbanks. So I got a hold of George.
Incredible person.
What's that?
An incredible person.
Oh, he's amazing. And he knows, you know, everything about that area. But his, you know, area of expertise is a little bit later, a couple of years later after this expedition is when his people got involved in that. So, but he knows all this stuff. He knows everything about it. And he said probably the most important nine words that anybody said to me in this entire project. He said, oh, there's this guy in London you got to get in touch with. And he put me in touch with this guy, Christopher, who lives in England, whose great-grandfather was on the same expedition. And he was actually good buddies with Randy's grandfather, who was on the expedition. And Christopher's great-grandfather left two diaries of this. And so I was, you know, emailing back and forth to Christopher every couple of days for 2 years, and he and I were sharing stuff that I knew and that he knew, and, you know, we both put this together. So there was a wealth of information, but, boy, you really had to dig to find it.
Keys, we are going to take a commercial break, okay?
Okay.
Fairbanks, you listen to KFAR Radio. We have Nick Nugent interviewing Keys about
the voyage of the Alaska Union.
We'll be back after these messages.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
One of the best traditions many Italian families hold dear is the weekly family meal. Families coming together under one roof, cooking a massive shared feast with food and drink while spending quality time with each other. Now, that's a great tradition. You can start your own family tradition with dinner at Giraldo's. Giraldo's has a menu that has something for everyone, from the littlest bambino to Nona and Nono. A weekly family meal. This is a tradition worth keeping. Eat well, drink well, enjoy life at Giraldo's.
Fairbanks Princess Riverside Lodge is seeking local team members for the up-and-coming season. We are offering a $500 sign-on bonus to local residents for the following positions: line cooks, sous chefs, and supervisors. Line cooks earn $20 an hour, sous chefs $22 an hour, and supervisors $21 an hour. Earn a free cruise based on contract completion. If you've ever been interested in working in the travel or food and beverage industry, now is a great time to apply. Go to AlaskaTourJobs.com and apply today. Our team is waiting for your application, and we're eager to speak with you.
As we get ready for summer, it's time to take a look at our equipment. It's probably time for an upgrade, and that means a trip to Craig Taylor Equipment. Their line of John Deere riding mowers is impressive. From those small weekly chores to commercial landscaping, Craig Taylor has the John Deere riding mower you need. Right now, Craig Taylor Equipment is giving you a free steel trimmer when you order a riding mower, and every purchase is backed with superior service. See Craig Taylor Equipment today on South Cushman near Van Horn. This year, before the snow melts, be prepared to take control of all that water with your new Honda water pump in stock now at the Woodway. Hoses and fittings, too. The selection is good, so don't wait on this. You'll find the Honda pump to match your specific commercial and residential needs. Honda your way through your toughest jobs. Buy your Honda outdoor power equipment today at the Woodway on College Road, your premier Honda servicing dealership. Working the Alaskan way, the right way, the Woodway.
Weather brought to you by the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks. Your eyes connect you to your world. Care for them with the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks, your eye health professionals on Mini Street.
KFAR weather.
Overcast skies today with highs around 62. East winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows level off around 39. Tonight, cloudy. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 62. Mid-60s Friday and Saturday with a chance for scattered rain showers Friday. That's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio with me here. And he goes, we call him Keys, but his stage name was Mr. White Keys. And we are interviewing him about the book,
The Voyage of the Alaska Union.
Nick, take over.
Thank you. Well, Keys, you've told us about how you met George and then Christopher, and how did what developed from that?
Well, it was just a wealth of information was unleashed, and it was it was just fabulous because all of a sudden I had these photographs and the manuscript, the story of his Charles Harris was the guy's name. He was a plumber from Chicago, and I had the basic story of his trip to Alaska. But all of a sudden, it got filled in with information from George and Christopher and, and all these other clippings and letters, and it just turned into this incredible story that now you didn't have just bits and pieces of it, but it was all, I was able to put it all together into a story of this expedition, which was the largest expedition ever organized to come to the Alaskan goldfield. I mean, there were 80 guys on this expedition, and it just turned into an incredible story that I couldn't even believe. And it's just it's part of our history, and now it's preserved.
Okay. Well, how about we maybe get into a little bit of a synopsis of the Alaska Union voyage and how those 80 people came together?
Okay. Well, it's the gold rush was big news in 1898, and it was all about the Klondike in Dawson City. And the people were just streaming up here. People from the Midwest were especially taken by this story. And so a lot of expeditions and a lot of guys came out of the Midwest that came up here. And most of them headed for the Klondike in Dawson. And most of them went by Skagway and the Chilkoot Pass and that route. But there was another route they called the Rich Man's Route, where guys would sail north from Seattle and go to St. Michael and transfer there to riverboats and get on the Yukon River and go all the way up to Dawson. Well, there was a shyster, of course, in Chicago.
That's a good S word. Seattle.
Well, he was a doubtful real estate guy, but was into making money any way he could. And he organized this expedition. He got 80 guys, mostly from Chicago and the farmland around there, but some from Baltimore, a few. And they all put in $500 to $1,000, and they had a cooperative venture. And so everything was owned by the company. And these guys gathered all the equipment they could in Chicago, and they took the train to Seattle, and they gathered more equipment, and they had supplies, food.
We just lost him. Okay, we're going to try and get him back on the air here. Give me a moment.
Well, we will try to get Mr. White Keys back. This is a wonderful story. I have myself done a bit of research on the Koyukuk country. I think maybe you all have heard some of the programs we've done right here on Problem Corner. What is pretty surprising to me is how many people actually went up the Koyukuk in 1898. We know that from a couple of maps and some other diaries that were left, there were maybe as many as 100 boats went up the river. There were mining camps all over all the different forks. And at one time, there were probably a full 1,000 people there. One of the things that's of interest is the number of people that were leaving or arriving in Dawson at one point during the summer of 1898 were pretty well matched.
Ready? Here we go. Keys, welcome back.
Okay, we got cut off. Sorry.
Hey, it's that North Korean equipment. Now we're bringing up a guy from Anchorage on Monday to fix for me.
Oh boy. Okay.
And he speaks South Korean, not North Korean.
Well, these guys, they started this expedition, a cooperative expedition. They got to Seattle. They loaded everything they needed for 2 years for 80 guys on a schooner, a three-masted sailing schooner, including all the food, all the equipment, plus all the materials they needed to build a 110-foot-long paddle wheel steamer to go up the Yukon. And this was, you know, all the wood, the boilers, the hardware, you know, everything they needed. And the idea was they were going to get up to north somewhere around maybe Hooper Bay, maybe St. Michael, build this steamer and go up the Yukon. They didn't plan to go all the way to Dawson, to the Klondike, because they'd heard about territory that looked really good in the Fairbanks area. Fairbanks hadn't been invented yet. It was before that. But they were going to go up the Tanana River. And but let alone the fact that they had all this material to build a boat, but they didn't have anybody of the 80 guys who had ever built a boat. I mean, these were greenhorns. They had no idea what they were doing. And they got into the Bering Sea and found that it was choked with ice. They were a little bit early. So they pulled into Nunavak Island, where they had to unload 2 years' worth of stuff and all the stuff they needed to build this 110-foot paddle-wheeler. And they unloaded it on the shores of Nunavak Island. And, you know, the schooner left. And they were alone there. Now, there were three small native villages at the time, but none of the natives spoke English, and there was no trading post. There was, you know, nothing except three villages of subsistence-level natives. So they didn't really have any help in any way, and they had to build this boat, or they were stranded. They couldn't get off Nunavak. And it took them about 6 weeks of, again, guys who had no idea how to build a boat, and they did. And then they had the problem of sailing a shallow draft, flat bottom riverboat across 150 miles of open ocean to even get to the mouth of the Yukon.
Yeah. And I'm willing to guess that not a one of them were professional sailors either.
They had two or three guys that had been sailors.
Okay.
So one of them was a captain from Baltimore.
So I guess I have to interject there on Nunavak Island. What did they use for fuel?
Well, okay, so they had brought, on the schooner, they brought multiple tons of coal to get them in the paddle boat. They were fairly well organized. So they had enough coal to get the paddle boat to the Yukon, and then they had to get up the Yukon far enough to where there was timber, where they could either buy timber from or buy fuel from the villages and outposts on the Yukon that sold fuel to the steamers, or till they could cut their own. So they, they had this huge amount of stuff that they were hauling, and they did build the boat, and they did get to the Yukon, although they almost died four or five times in storms and squalls before they got there. And then they just had to get up the Yukon, where they had no idea what they were doing, and they ran onto sandbars, you know, every day or two, and had to either unload half of their, you know, hundreds of tons of freight in order to lighten the load to get off the sandbar, or hopefully the river went up and they were able to tow it off by, you know, manpower. And it was just, these guys were surviving under unbelievable circumstances, and they just did what they had to do. I mean, that's what you did in 1898. I mean, you know, people weren't wimps. They didn't have the opportunity to call a repairman from Anchorage to come up.
Fixing North Korean equipment.
Yeah, they had to do it themselves, and they had to figure out how to do it, you know, in spite of the fact that they'd never done it before. They didn't know how.
Keys, we're going to take a break here. We're going to go into, got a little bit of bumper music that it's called Spin Doctors, and it's worse than North Korean equipment, I think. But then we're going to go into Fox News, state news, some commercials, some weather, and we will be back, and I will go across the hallway and I'll give Rock Candy a good what for about this music.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein's been out for about 3 months with an illness, returning to Capitol Hill with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer welcoming her.
It's so good to see her back here in the Senate, ready to get back to work. I've been in touch with Senator Feinstein over the past few weeks, and I can report she's exactly where she wants to be.
She had a bout of the shingles. We're glad she's feeling better, although she did not attend the first vote on the Senate floor this morning. So that's curious. Title 42 is set to expire tomorrow. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says states should be able to enforce border laws if the federal government can't do it.
I think a good reform federally would be deputize states to enforce immigration law. Texas should be able to send them back to Mexico or back to these other countries.
America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
National park officials in Alaska say two missing mountain climbers likely triggered a small avalanche. A Denali National Park and Preserve spokesperson said Tuesday the projected path of their suspected fall would end at a heavily crevassed glacier. The glacier will be the focus for aerial search efforts in the coming days. However, weather was preventing any searches on Tuesday. Missing are Eli Michael of Columbia City, Indiana, and Nafuan Awal of Seattle. They are presumed to have fallen Friday while climbing the West Ridge route of Moose's Tooth, a 10,300-foot mountain in Denali National Park. The search began Friday, and rangers have found their tracks leading to the avalanche site. The Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service and the 11th Airborne Division began prescribed fires on military training land Sunday. According to a news release, prescribed burns are intentionally set fires that reduce dry and dead grass and lower the risk of wildfires. Prescribed burns will take place at the Donnelly Training Area near Delta Junction, the Yukon Training Area near Eielson Air Force Base and Salcha, and on Fort Wainwright throughout
streaming
the month.
Online at KFAR660.com.
Save now on Bridgestone and Firestone tires at GCR. Receive your Visa prepaid card of up to $70 when you buy a set of four eligible tires. All-terrain models for solid on- and off-road performance for your light truck and SUV, or touring models for superb highway handling for your car. Submit your rebate online. Receive your Visa prepaid card by mail. Shop now. Offer ends September 4th. Details at GCR Tires and Service. The Tire Guys. Taming the Alaskan Road. Van Horn at Cushman.
The Fairbanks Clinic has been here for you since 1932, the year Amelia Earhart completed the first female nonstop solo flight across the Atlantic, the year BBC aired their first television broadcast. That was over 90 years ago, and they're still here, still taking care of you and your family. That's the Fairbanks Clinic in their beautiful building at the corner of Cushman and Gaffney. Call and schedule your appointment today with their family care practice. That's the Fairbanks Clinic, here for you since 1932.
Did you miss your favorite local show on KFAR Radio? Just log on to our website, KFARradio.com, and click the Archives tab to find all past episodes of shows like Problem Corner, Health Talk, Fairbanks Foodies, Alaska Realty Today, Shooter's Corner, and the Compos Outdoor Show. Hours of entertaining, informative, local programs produced exclusively for KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Online at KFARradio.com. We are KFAR, the heartbeats of Alaska.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM,
and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I'm Nick Nugent in the studio, and I got Keys calling in from Anchorage, and we're talking about the voyage of...
the Alaska Union.
Not voyage of the dam, because so far it's not sounding good for these poor souls.
They were like a lot of other guys. They obviously took off with what they knew, which wasn't always what the conditions were.
Oh, it absolutely wasn't. They had no idea what they were getting into. And, and then it got worse.
It got worse?
Oh, it totally got worse. As they made their way up the Yukon, finally, they got to the mouth of the Koyukuk. It was the village of Koyukuk, which was like two log cabins at the time. And they intended to keep on going up the Yukon to the Tanana and wind up sort of near where Fairbanks is today. But they ran into some con men. There were grifters at Koyukuk. And these guys, their job was to convince guys going up the river, mostly toward the Klondike and Dawson, and convince them that there was tons of gold to be had up the Koyukuk if they just changed their destination and go up there. Well, the reason these guys were doing that was because they were on the payroll of the only guys that owned a trading post on the entire Koyukuk at that time. So for 600-700 miles, there was one trading post. And these guys convinced over 2,000 miners to divert and go up the Koyukuk because of the riches that were there. But it was all done because these guys owned the only trading post on the river. And, of course, 2,000 people went up the Koyukuk, and there was hardly any gold at the time on the Koyukuk. But
I see where E.T. Barnett, our founder of Fairbanks, learned the trade. He did the same.
Yeah. Well, this whole thing was just incredible. And all these guys went up there. The Alaska Union went up another 500-600 miles up the Koyukuk, where they built a little town of 15 log cabins they called Union City. And then they fanned out from there. The guys took skiffs and went, 100 miles up each direction from there. And it was just this, they had to build this town in 3 weeks because it was getting near freeze-up and it was getting pretty darn cold by the time they got there near the end of August. And then they were faced with one of the coldest winters ever on the Koyukuk. And again, these guys were not prepared for it, and they just got thrown into it. But in 1898, that's what you did. You had no choice. You had to make do with what you had, and these guys were incredibly resourceful in what they were able to pull off.
Well, I think it shows that some of their resourcefulness, when you mentioned they had no maritime carpenters on board, but the photo you have, the Alaska Union was a pretty good-looking boat.
Oh, it's an incredible-looking boat. They had one guy. Well, it turned out that Christopher in London's great-grandfather was a carpenter, and he had never built a boat before, but he was a pretty capable carpenter, and he was pretty much put in charge of the boat. And they had a basic plan, which was a pencil sketch.
Oh, no.
And that was what they had. But they had the boilers and stuff, and they had a basic idea of how to do it, and they did. And this boat, the photographs of it, it's mammoth. It's, over 100 feet long. And they pulled it off. But they didn't do it without trouble. And here's one example of something that showed up in all this. On the way up the Koyukuk had a lot of sandbars, and then it was twisty and turny, and they ran aground one point, and they were seriously aground on a sandbar. And they had to unload about half of their cargo, which was a huge amount. So they unloaded half of this cargo, and then they went up the Koyukuk another couple hundred miles, and they established Union City. And then the paddle wheeler went back downstream to get all the rest of the gear that they'd unloaded. Well, in the time they got back down there, the river, the Koyukuk, had risen, and all the stuff they unloaded was now under 8 feet of water. And they managed to salvage it. They hadn't unloaded any of the food or anything, but it was all gear. And they managed to salvage it. And they got back to Union City, and they unloaded it, and they found that one thing was missing, was this iron cog wheel that was the central part of the sawmill that they'd bought. So now the sawmill is totally inoperable, and they can't saw the boards they need for the floors of the cabins or the roofs of the cabins and stuff. And they were totally prepared with the sawmill, the boiler, the saw blade itself, the giant smokestack for the steam part of the boiler. But they didn't have the cogwheel. And so it was going to take like a year and a half to get one. By the time they sent word back down to Chicago and had a cogwheel made and got it sent back, it'd be a year and a half. And they had like 3 weeks till freeze up. So they had a blacksmith on board. And the blacksmith had an anvil and a forge. And they had bunches of scrap metal, but there was all sort of steel bars, iron bars. So he had to weld and forge these bars together into a plate with, you know, with hammers and tongs and the forge and the anvil. And he made a flat piece of metal, which then he had to cut out by hand with a saw and a file. And they didn't have any pattern for it, so they had to estimate the size of the gears on this cogwheel according to the gears that they had that were in place already for the sawmill. And then they had to do the notch in it, you know, so that it would turn with the machinery. And basically, in about 10 days, the guy did manage to build a cogwheel that would work, and they got the sawmill working. So they were able to saw the lumber they needed in order to have floors and ceilings in their log cabin.
Wow.
That certainly makes true the statement, necessity is the mother of invention.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these guys did that, I mean, basically for a couple of years. And every time they ran into a problem like that, they had to solve it because they didn't have any other choice. It could be 40, 50, 60 below, and they had the supplies they had, and they had, if they didn't have it, they had to make it.
When they were, did you get any idea? You said they never planned on going to Dawson. Do you know how early on that they had begun to realize that Dawson was not the best location?
Well, that was actually at the beginning of the expedition. I mean, they had this idea that somehow the Tanana River was where they wanted to go. And it's not mentioned in any of the documents, you know, why they thought that. They had just heard that. And I think they also thought they wanted to stay in the U.S. because there were, you know, there were problems in getting into Canada. There were huge tariffs. I mean, anything you brought in was taxed. And, you know, there were regulations and stuff. And I think they just thought they'd be better off in, you know, in the U.S. And they had, again, heard there was also gold in Tanana. So that's where they were headed.
It's an interesting story that they chose the Tanana. Prior to getting here, there were three riverboats came up the Tanana and as far as up the Chena, but that was late 1898, 1899 through 1901. These guys were literally on the cutting edge of figuring out where to go.
Well, they were. They were early, you know, and they somehow had this idea and they were there, but the con men in Koyukuk got to them first.
We're going to take a commercial break. Fairbanks, we'll be right back.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
The Fairbanks Hearing and Ballot Center has big news. It's that time when all the major hearing aid manufacturers release new products. Dr. Marianne McElwain and her team are excited to already dispense the latest products from Starkey, Phonak, and ReSound, but they're even prouder to offer best practices to fit your hearing aids using systems like Real Ear to better fit your hearing aids to your specific hearing loss. They even offer lower-cost hearing devices fitted by a licensed audiologist with a warranty and service plan. It's time to hear better and feel better. It's all at the Fairbanks Hearing and Ballot Center. Find out more at fairbankshearing.com.
Wings on Wednesdays for just $1.50 each. That's every Wednesday at Big Daddy's. Wings the way you like them. Slow smoked and delicious with great choice of styles, including original buffalo and sweet honey barbecue, to name just a few. Come by Wednesday for wings at Big Daddy's and load your plate up with some of those sides that speak Southern, like collard greens, red beans and rice, and so many other choices. It's the award-winning northernmost Southern barbecue. Big Daddy's on Wickersham between 1st and 2nd Avenue.
The truth be told, I do not mind being a septic tank. I stay quite busy. I'm an avid reader. I've taught myself the language of the raven. Fascinating creatures, but horrible gossips. Until recently, I have had aspirations to be the first septic tank on Mars. But I know my job is right here, buried in my family's yard. Bigfoot Pumpin' and Thawin' pumps me out once a year, and I continue to serve my family much better.
KFAR weather.
Overcast skies today with a high of 62. East winds 5 to 10 miles per hour.
Overcast again tonight. Lows dip down to about 39. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 62. Temperatures a bit above average Friday and Saturday with highs in the mid-60s. Chance for scattered rain showers Friday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. We have Keys calling in from Anchorage and Nick Nugent conducting an interview.
Thanks, Dave. I have been enjoying this quite a bit.
So have I.
You know, I've been interested in that period of time just prior to and between Dawson and Fairbanks, and this is a really another nice part of that story.
This is something I've never, a portion I've never heard of. So Keys, thank you for, and Nick, thank you for this research and the story, you know, giving me the cliff notes of it. This is great.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure for me to be talking to you, and I'm totally jealous because you're going to be in the mid-60s here in Anchorage. We've barely gotten over 50 on 2 days yet.
It's Fairbanks. We're coming into summer. We're getting our leaves ready to sprout.
And, you know, I mean, I'm ready to come up there. I 60 degrees.
You know? I know. And here we are talking about people that had so many turmoils and tribulations were spoiled.
Well, here's another little story about these guys. When they got to they got to Union City and they established their camp or their little city or settlement, they took off in all directions, and about you know, the 15 of these guys, or close to 15 of them, wound up 100 miles up the South Fork of the Koyukuk, and they established a winter camp where they were going to prospect during the winter, and then six of those went another 100 miles up Bear Creek and had another winter camp. So the guys that were in the first camp, 100 miles from the headquarters, it was getting to be late October. It was down around 20 or 30 below. And they hadn't had any mail since they left Seattle in April. And this was late October. So they sent Charles Harris, who was Randy's grandfather. He brought ice skates with him. And he knew how to skate. So he and another guy had skates. And they were going to skate 100 miles down the South Fork of Koyukuk to headquarters to see if there was any mail. And it's, you know, 20, 30 below, and they was 100 miles. They said, we could skate that in a day. So they didn't bother to take tents. They took a blanket, and they had their skates, and they took enough food for 2 days. And they got 20 miles into it, and it started snowing, and they couldn't skate anymore. So now they had to put their boots on, and they were 80 miles from headquarters, and they had 2 days' worth of food and no tents, and they did. I mean, they kept going, and 4 days later, on 2 days' rations and, you know, no warm stuff, and they fell in the river a couple times and had to build fires and dry out their clothes and warm up. But that's what you did to get the mail.
And we complain if our packages from Amazon come a day late.
Were they successful in their gold mining adventures?
Well, not very much. There were guys on the Koyukuk that got some gold. It wasn't anything like the Klondike strikes. It wasn't anything like that. There were a few guys that got maybe a few thousand dollars. But in general, they didn't. And then they spent that winter, which was brutal, and for everybody on the Koyukuk. And the next spring of 1899, as soon as the ice went out, 90% of the people on the Koyukuk left. They'd had scurvy all winter. They'd frozen. They were in really bad shape. 90% of them left, but a lot of them then headed up the Yukon and did go to the Klondike. And a lot of them went to Nome, which had just been discovered that winter. So the territory emptied out. Well, after that was when the few guys that were left on the Koyukuk started ranging farther and farther upstream, And that was when they got to Myrtle Creek and Slate Creek around where Coldfoot is today and Wiseman. And that's where the gold was found. So the majority of the gold on the Koyukuk was found after the majority of the guys left. And it was found farther upstream. And then that's when Nick and George Lounsbury and all the people that you have all the photographs from and all the history from were up there just a couple years after these guys got there in the first place.
Wow.
So you've done an amazing amount. You've put together, and I've seen it online, the preliminary book, if you will. What are your future plans for it?
Well, okay, so there's a little problem here. We've got a 300...
You're on Problem Corner.
Yeah, Problem Corner. There's a 300-page book, and it's a totally complete version of this expedition with about 120 photographs that were taken by Charles Harris. And the photographs have to be fairly large. So, you know, I laid this out as an 8.5 by 11, you know, thing, because you don't want tiny little snapshots. There's historic information to be gotten from these photographs. So it's a fairly large format book that has to be printed with, you know, high-resolution photographs on good paper so the photographs don't bleed through to the photographs on the back. And this just becomes a very expensive thing to print. So far, you know, I mean, this would cost more than a dozen eggs, more than a gallon of gas, you know. I mean, this is a lot of money to just print it. So, you know, there aren't any publishers that are dumb enough to do this. And so I laid it out as an ebook PDF. So you have to read it on your computer, but it's in its full resolution and size. And it's laid out the way it would be exactly if you had a book. But it's got to be digital online. And I'm still looking for a reasonably decent price where I can get these printed. But that's difficult. And it can be done in North Korea by the same guy that's going to...
Yeah.
but that would take... shipping alone would be, you know, 5 or 6 months, let alone the printing time. So that's still a possibility, but at the present time, you can just get it off my website really cheap in the digital form. You just go to MrWhiteKeys.com, and it'll download to your computer.
Yeah, you know, my thought is sometime you should come up and visit the Miners Hall of Fame and tell the story and give a presentation.
Oh, I'd love to. No, yeah. I'd love to.
Yeah. I'll see what Nick can set up for you.
Okay, no, that'd be fabulous. Slideshow is set up, it's ready to go. I can show you this with the details, the annotations with the slides and I'd love to do that.
We'll get it set up for you, Keys. That I think I can do.
Especially because it's over 60 degrees up there.
Mosquitoes aren't out yet, but they're going to be here soon.
I actually killed 3 mosquitoes on my birthday last Friday.
Oh man, I've not put the cutters of the off in my car yet.
I'm afraid it's coming.
So what out of this whole discovery process of yours? What was those one or two things that you just found that stunned you? That just said, wow. Your wow moments.
Well, actually, one of them, and I'll try to be brief about this, had to do with the natives of the area, and there weren't very many in that area. It wasn't very productive. But when 2,000 miners showed up, you know, the food supply disappeared.
Yeah.
And if they didn't drive off the game or kill it, they stole it from the natives' caches that they had stashed up. But for once in the history of the United States and Alaska, the miners realized that they had just trashed this culture. And they actually had a meeting in early 1899, and the miners pitched in money and got the trading post to pitch in and they supplied the natives who were starving to death with like 100 days worth of food that tied them over until the salmon run hit again. And then they went to Congress and sent a guy to Congress to get Congress to pay him back, which they finally did. It took 10 years, but they did. And this was like $80,000 in today's money that they used to allocate food to the natives, the families, and even their dogs. There were rations of bacon for the dogs to get them through the winter.
Wow.
And that, I thought, was a pretty amazing story. And that was buried. There's only one sentence in any of the archives about this expedition that even mentions that. But the documentation was from the Congressional Record.
How did this union dissolve? We got about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so that was it. I mean, they provided the food, and it was just an amazing story.
So after they provided the food, they left.
Well, pretty much, yeah. Most of the men, you know, 90% of the guys left the Koyukuk area entirely that following summer.
Whatever happened to the boat?
Well, the boat was eventually it was stranded up the South Fork and spent the winter, and they expected it to be ground up by the ice and the breakup, but somehow miraculously it survived. And it took most of the guys back out to St. Michael that summer, where it was sold, and all these other riverboats, there were 100 riverboats for sale, and no market for them.
Oh, boy.
Somehow this one did sell, and then a year later, when Charles Harris and Christopher's great-grandfather headed out to St. Michael, they found it wrecked on the beach, where it had wrecked on a shoal off the shore of St. Michael. So this boat had been through a lot, and it had run aground a couple of times, and the second or third time was its demise.
Wow, goodness. We got about 2 minutes left, sir. How do you want to end it?
Oh, man, I just, I'm just totally amazed at this whole story and how tough these guys were. Two of the guys, including Christopher's great-grandfather, had gone back to Seattle in 1899, and then gone back to Chicago, and then word came that the company had discovered some claims near Coldfoot. And so these guys decided it was all company property, they better check on it. So two of them took off again in February and took a boat to Skagway. The White Pass Railroad had been built 20 miles, so they got the first 20 miles. They didn't have to go over the pass. And then these two guys walked from the end of the White Pass Railroad near Skagway to Coldfoot in the winter, like 1,100 miles.
Wow.
They walked just to see what was happening with their claim. And they got there, and of course, not much was happening.
Well, hey, time for our show to close. Greatly appreciate it. We'll be in touch with you in regards to getting a presentation at the Miners Hall of Fame with this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to somebody where it's 62 degrees.
Remember that. You have a great day, Keys. Bye.
Okay, thank you.
Great show, Nick. Wow, great setup.
It was. This story and the Courier Expedition, some of the others, sure give us a different idea of what was going on in the interior prior to Felix Pedro.
Fairbanks, that is our show. You have a great day. I will see you next week. It's Friday. I'll be gone, and Melissa Burnett will be handling it.